Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe. I'm Thomas Hill. Today I'm very pleased to be talking with Kathleen Hart, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of French and Francophone Studies here at Vassar College, who is with us to talk about her book, Revolution and Women's Autobiography in 19th Century France, published by Rodopi. Welcome, Kathleen.
Hello, Tom.
Generally, your book is about three French women of the 19th century who published autobiographies recounting their extraordinary lives, but it's also about the social and political culture of France that developed in the wake of the French Revolution.
That's true. These autobiographers would say that everything after 1789 was an experiment, not just the socialist movements or revolutions that didn't succeed as they'd hoped. There was a series of governments and policies that didn't fulfill the ideals of 1789. And so they took that chaos as a sign that humanity was struggling to realize its socialist destiny.
And then there were a series of sort of aftershock revolutions through the 19th century in France?
That's correct, but people often point to those revolutions as the only sign of chaos. Actually, throughout the 19th century, life was chaotic for a great many people. Workers who were underpaid, who were starving, there were many slums, there was prostitution, there was a cholera epidemic. So the revolutions, they're a way to identify a period of massive transition and upheaval.
So in terms of the intertwining of the personal and political in these autobiographies, which is very much what your book is about, you remark on the first page of the book that these narratives all give the impression that if any of these women had been born before the 1789 revolution, it's doubtful they would have had any life story to tell at all. And this reminded me of George Steiner's characterization of the French Revolution and its effect on the emergence of a new idea of historical time and history itself. You know, so I went back and read that essay that he published in book form. It's called Bluebeard Castle, and it's quite early. He wrote it, I think, in 1971. And he writes there that before 1789, history had been, in his words, very largely the privilege and terror of the few in respect to a defined consciousness. And then he goes on to say, it's the events of 1789 and 1815 that interpenetrate common private existence with the perception of historical processes. Henceforth in Western culture, each day was to bring news. And I had been also reading Carolyn Steedman's book called Dust, the Archive and Cultural History, and she makes the point that this is the beginning of the archive in France and the French National Archives.
Uh-huh.
So all this is leading up to the question, can you talk a bit about the relation between history and autobiography in France during this period and the idea of an historical self?
It's really interesting to mention Steiner because in the 1960s in France, a lot of the revolutions, student uprising, especially May 68, referred back to the 1871 Commune, the Paris Commune, that they saw that the communards, they were inspired by their way of uniting revolution with new forms of expression. In terms of the interpenetration of private existence and historical consciousness, it's true that 1789 was pivotal. It gave subsequent generations something very definite to latch onto. But the interpenetration of private existence with historical consciousness was already underway prior to 1789.
Mm-hmm.
In France, the word for history, histoire, is the same as the word for story. And it's important to remember that in the 18th century, people were reading as never before, and they were reading stories. They were beginning to think of themselves as characters in novels, and they were beginning to think of historical figures as characters in novels.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was already this tendency of people to think of their lives as epic narratives, in a sense. And you see that in Rousseau's Confessions, which were put out before the Revolution.
Uh-huh. We were talking last week on the show with literary historian Jennifer Fegley about 19th century family literary periodicals and the way they helped to define a place for women in American and British society during this period.
Unfortunately, in France, the male-dominated press perceived women writers as rivals.
Mm-hmm.
Journalists were also book reviewers who were also very often aspiring novelists themselves. And the easiest way to eliminate half of your competition is to denigrate women's writing. And so the sentimental codes on which women relied and often had to rely in order to be accepted as writers were denigrated in favor of realist codes.
Yeah.
This is the thesis of Margaret Cohen in The Sentimental Education of the Novel. But it's very true also, I think, of women's autobiography. That's why George Sand resorted to a male pseudonym.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So are there similar family literary magazines like Harper's and the Cornhill in France at the time that provide some venue for women writers, even writing in a sentimental vein?
Yes, but the thing is that again, it's a question of what gets taken seriously
yeah.
as literature.
Yeah, sure.
So that the novel of ideas became the province of men, and
yeah.
everything else was just called novels for chambermaids.
And of course, there is an academy in France that determines taste, which, I mean, she mentioned actually that Matthew Arnold suggests that the British do the same, precisely to regulate this popular culture as they perceived it that was challenging the male-dominated literary scene.
Well, they couldn't regulate it as much as they wanted.
Yeah.
There's a question of what they said was worth reading,
yeah.
and then the question of what people actually read, whether they admitted it or not.
Is the notion of the intimate family sphere, especially of the bourgeois family in France, and this being a confining, socially isolating place for women, a product of this time, or is it intensified at this time?
I would say that it was codified. You have the nuclear family already replacing larger kinship structures in the late 17th century. You have a growing ideology of womanhood, of gender in the 18th century,
mm-hmm.
Belief in public discourse that women should be relegated to the domestic sphere. But it's after the French Revolution that the Napoleonic Code actually put it in writing
mm-hmm.
that, for instance, married women had to be that their husbands were their masters. They needed permission from their husbands to work or to travel. They were barred from voting or political office. All those things were put into law very clearly mm. after the revolution.
So the revolutionary governments don't exactly take up the cause of women as public actors in the New World Order?
Well, no. Actually, after the revolution, there's no more king, but that's so each man can be king of his own castle
mm-hmm.
and master over his wife. Or that's the bourgeois ideal.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you write in the book a little about Madame Roland, who was a mm-hmm. 1789 revolutionary.
Yeah. Madame Roland, I would not call her an avowed feminist.
Yeah.
But she's an interesting pivotal figure. And she's also a model for the women autobiographers that I'm writing about, because she, too, united her personal experience with political process. So that she writes about her father trying to give her medicine and she refused to swallow it.
Mm-hmm.
And she shows that same resolve when she defies her executioners. And
Yeah, she's executed by the revolution, isn't she?
Yeah, well, more because she was a Girondin.
Yeah.
She was of the party that lost out. But when she was executed, they described why they were doing it in gendered terms.
Mm-hmm.
This was a woman who had tried to play a man's role.
Yeah. So there are other women precursors in France, two or three autobiographers, though, that you also write about, Madame de Staël
yes.
and
Madame Guyon.
Madame Guyon.
Yes. In fact, I read many, many autobiographies
mm-hmm.
and just many kinds of writings that could be considered memoirs or first-person novels. I chose to write specifically about Madame Guyon and Madame de Staël to make the point that a challenge for women publishing or writing an autobiography is to establish that they're submitting to a higher power, even if they're defying the laws of men.
Mm-hmm.
So that Madame Guyon was challenging the Catholic Church, and she believed in the individual's immediate experience of God. She was a mystic, a quietist,
mm-hmm.
and for that she was punished. And Staël was exiled by Napoleon, but she allies the story of that exile with her story of a revolution betrayed by Napoleon. So it compensates in a way for what could be perceived as antisocial and unwomanly.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they're showing that they are guided by principles and religious authorities or noble
yeah.
causes.
Yeah. And there's some, you know, being a medievalist, there's some precedent for this that goes all the way back to the Middle Ages, isn't there?
Well, it's true that as I did my research, I did study Christine de Pizan, and especially her writings on Joan of Arc.
Uh-huh.
Because what she was doing was creating a heroine of Joan of Arc that, in a sense, validated her own status as a woman with a public role.
Yeah, and religion in this case in the Middle Ages was the platform that a woman could cross over into
public ceremony. And the degree to which that's a rhetorical move is something we can never be sure of.
You talk a lot in the book about the political and social movements going on, many of which I would expect many people who aren't versed specifically in the 19th century wouldn't know about, but these were really quite important precursors to Marxism and and 20th century political theory. So can you talk a bit about some of the romantic, experimental, social, and political movements that were going on in France in the first half of the 19th century, and also how these inform a developing idea of the self and its role in the world?
Yes. Well, there were the doctrines, and then there were the movements, which were attempts to put into practice various doctrines. I think what they all have in common, Fourierism, Saint-Simonism, the philosophy of Pierre Leroux, many, many others. There were so many very odd messianic figures at the time as well. They all emphasize interdependency, and they all challenge traditional hierarchies so that whatever defines feminine is as important as whatever defines masculine. Manual labor is just as important as intellectual labor. And to create a society that reflects those values, individuals have to change. They have to change their sense of self and recognize in themselves the traits that usually got associated only with one sex or one class of people. So the idea behind those movements is that creating a just society means reconceptualizing who you are, your beliefs about yourself, and your role in the collective. And this is an idea that is not emphasized, I think, by Marx later on.
So Marx borrows from this earlier socialist theory, but its feminist and certainly religious elements don't carry over?
It was actually Flora Tristan who first said that workers of the world should unite.
Oh, was it? That's interesting. That's very interesting.
Well, there are letters that show that Marx was putting together a library, and his goal was to read through all these French utopian socialists and get rid of the gobbledygook. He could get rid of the nonsense,
he
said. The workers' movements inspired by Marx, the Marxist movements later on, did not put feminism at the center of their concerns or their doctrines. And that's what the early socialists did. Although, of course, I think that Marx himself, Marxist analysis is extremely valuable and useful for feminist theory.
Today,
Yes.
The nonsense you mentioned that I expect Marx would have been filtering out of this utopian theory would have been its romanticism. And in the Steiner essay I mentioned, Steiner warns about the despair, you know, what he calls ennui, the bitterness and nihilism that set in the latter part of the 19th century when it becomes apparent that the hopes of the revolution are not going to be realized. And in fact, Steiner sees this contributing to the horrors of the first half of the 20th century in Europe. But in any case, all three women autobiographers that you examine in the book seem to mitigate against despair and anti-sentimental detachment in that all three are basically optimistic and their works are resonant with the organic, expressive utopianism that you certainly find in much of the romantic poetry of the earlier part of the century, even though their lives contained many events that might have driven them to despair. You know, I don't find them pessimistic at all. No matter how hard things are for them, there's a kind of romantic hopefulness conveyed in their work.
Yes. I think it's an affirmation of the ideal. And that one can always find reasons to despair. But a reason not to despair is that it makes you unhappy and it makes others unhappy. And I think that they felt that they were upholding their ideal to the extent that they could continue to affirm. I don't think it means they were necessarily unaware of the realities. They were aware to varying degrees.
No, no, I wouldn't suggest that they were in this kind of romantic fog because they tend to be kind of hard-headed in many ways and certainly perceptive about what they're up against.
I'm not sure they were always that perceptive. I think Louise Michel, I think she was a bit deluded by her own conception of revolution. But I wouldn't call her any crazier than the French society that declared war on Prussia.
Does autobiography then become perhaps of necessity a political tool for women writers in this period, do you think?
Autobiography is always political. It's always political.
Even Barbara Walters?
Well, yes, in the sense that if someone has the luxury of not being political, they're already... they're enjoying the privileges of those who assume that they're simply writing something and taking the existing order for granted. I'm not acquainted with Barbara Walters' autobiography. No. For these women, though, I would say that if you are barred from political action, then at least you can write a life story that establishes that the public stories being circulated about women are lies. Mm-hmm. That you can write a life story that shows that the gender ideology is contradicted by your reality.
So autobiography then serves this end perhaps better than other kinds of genre, do you think? Novels, poetry?
I wouldn't say that. No. I would say that they complement each other and that they exist in opposition to each other and because of each other. Yeah. If you think of James Frey, you know, the recent controversy over the autobiography he wrote, and it turned out he invented things. And then there was this huge debate, well, autobiographers are always, to an extent, making things up. Well, you can't even have that debate unless you have an understanding of two different types of texts, one which is supposedly invented and the other which is supposedly based on real historical events.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because autobiography is, to some extent, in some way, about self-invention, isn't it? The invention of a real self, maybe, but the invention of a self.
Yes, but it depends on readers. There's a notion of reader's reception on which you are relying.
Yeah.
And the value of a story can change depending on whether you think it's true or whether someone's attempting to pass it off as fiction.
Yeah.
Really.
And does this type of self-expression develop out of the diary form that women commonly would engage in, still do today?
That's true, that people wrote diaries. They also wrote letters.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
Think of how often people had to write letters.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they were constantly constructing a self in relation to an other, an I and a you.
Mm-hmm.
So Flora Tristan actually wrote her autobiography by drawing upon entries in the journal she kept.
Oh, interesting. That
is
interesting, yeah. Because in some respects, then, the autobiography seems to sort of almost bridge private and public expression, or at least it grows out of that private expression, because it grows out of a private life.
That's true.
Yeah.
But the moment of publication is really crossing the last divide.
Yeah. So how do these autobiographies break with the autobiographical models of Augustine of Hippo and Rousseau?
Well, there are ways in which these autobiographies by Tristan and Michel and Sand take up some features of religious autobiography, mm-hmm. a la Augustine, and ways in which they take up features of Rousseau's mm-hmm. autobiography, so that there's a religious character to their autobiographies that's missing from Rousseau's autobiography, even if he does address God.
Yeah.
And then there's novelistic language and self-dramatization and emphasis on childhood that one finds in their autobiographies that we find in Rousseau, so that they're breaking with each of those traditions, possibly by recombining features of each of them.
Interesting. So maybe we should look at the autobiographies that you write about in turn by these three writers, starting with Flora Tristan and her Peregrinations of a Pariah.
Yeah, this is an amazingly clever text. When I first read it, I was translating passages of it for my professor at UC Irvine, Leslie Rabin, who's a women's studies professor. I took many courses with her on feminist theory, feminism, and Marxism. And at the time, I found it very off-putting, Flora Tristan's. I thought her language was overblown and sentimental. It went against all my notions of a sophisticated intellectual. And yet, the more I studied her text, the more I realized how amazingly clever it is. For instance, she begins not with her birth, but with her ocean voyage, and then goes back in time, so that from the moment she begins the main part of her text, the reader is traveling with her to another land in which all kinds of new possibilities for a socialist future can be imagined with her.
Yeah, maybe we should go over the main points of her life, because it's an incredibly interesting story, certainly as she tells it.
Oh, yes. She really exploits the aspects of her life, which are all the stuff of melodrama.
Yeah.
Her father was a Peruvian nobleman. Her mother was a French commoner. They tried to marry secretly. They couldn't get a civil marriage, so that technically Flora Tristan was born illegitimate, so that when her father passed away, the inheritance went to her father's family. So at that time, she was living in Paris, and she grew up always wanting to meet her uncle, who lived in Peru, her father's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the story of how she left her husband, who was abusive, and traveled to Peru hoping for the loving support and financial assistance of her uncle. And she constructs that narrative as a religious quest in which she gradually becomes, in a sense, a woman messiah, so that at midpoint in the narrative, when her uncle rejects her, the reader is already prepared to see her in quite a different role than that of the niece of this Peruvian aristocrat. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, revolution breaks out in Peru while she's there, and writing her autobiography later, she appears to be using the Peruvian Revolution as a caricature of France. Mm-hmm. And so that she very cleverly points to the causes of the revolution and the inadequacies of the leaders in ways that suggest what's going on in France in the wake of the 1830 revolution. And yet, by describing this other culture, Peru, she's able to suggest that the French are somehow superior to the Peruvians, precisely because she's trying to present the French as people who are closer to a socialist society than Peru. So it's very clever what she does.
As I read it, just through your paraphrasing of it, it does read like a medieval quest narrative very much, and it seems very much as much a psychological self-exploration as it is an exploration of the society it comes out of. Do you have that sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. She uses these experiences of dramatic exile and wandering to reinforce the religious and political meaning of her life. But she also devotes quite a lot of her text to describing other people. And that's a strategy we often find in women's writing, that a way of developing or reconstructing the self is to describe many other people so that they all emerge as various positive or negative role models, so that indirectly the autobiographer is developing a notion of who she is or could be without falling into the trap of defining herself according to the roles that are available at the time and which are not really very satisfying.
Yeah. One of the roles available in terms of allegorical iconography is the figure of liberty that's so prominent in France at the time. And I'm thinking, of course, of Delacroix's Liberty Leading the People, and also later on of Bartholdi's great statue in New York Harbor that still looms large in the world consciousness as a political symbol. And you write about that a bit.
Yes, I had great fun with that. I was studying Flora Tristan, and during that time I took a trip what was then the Soviet Union, and I was very struck by the female monuments in the Soviet Union. Suddenly I thought, well, there could be a connection between these strong women statues and democracy or socialism. I thought that. And then, of course, when I came home, I learned that many people, Marina Warner, Lynn Hunt, that many people were writing about female iconography in statues and paintings, Marcia Poynton. And so that was what inspired me to try to understand how that could relate to what struck me as sort of iconographic images that kept popping up in Flora Tristan's writings, that she may have seen liberty figures as potential women actors. Yeah. And this flies in the face of a lot of theories about female allegory. A lot of people are fond of arguing that no one looked at allegorical figures and imagined real women acting most of the time. But I think there's a lot in Flora Tristan's writing to indicate that she did see a connection between the image of liberty on the barricades and real women acting. And of course, Liberty on the Barricades is a controversial painting precisely because it breaks with allegorical tradition somewhat. It looks like an allegory, and yet there's hair under her arms.
Yeah, it's a great work. It's interesting the way the narrative of Flora Tristan's life in the autobiography continues after the publication of Peregrinations. And you talk about the lives of politically active women as what you term live allegories, but her adventures continue after the autobiography is over.
Yes, although the working class movement that celebrated her after her death did tend to write of her and speak of her in allegorical terms, the mother of the socialist movement. In a sense, political women tend to be interpreted as symbols of all womanhood. That tends to happen anyway.
But she's shot by her estranged husband when she gets home. Is he upset about the autobiography?
He was upset about the autobiography, about the way she represented him, the fact that she even left him at all and wrote an autobiography, and he shot her in the head. She didn't die, but I think the bullet remained in her head until her death, and she died rather early.
The next individual you talk about in the book is George Sand, writing a bit later, and her quest for solidarity.
Yeah, George Sand, she was a novelist. Everyone knows she's a famous novelist of the time, celebrated for wearing men's clothing and smoking cigars. And
friend of Chopin.
Yes, the lover of Chopin and many others. Yeah. She's a very, very interesting figure because she's really the one 19th century female writer who achieved great commercial success. Mm. Some people think she was too elitist to be considered a socialist or even a feminist. I included her in my autobiographies because she herself called herself a socialist.
Yeah.
And it's the word that interests me, not whether anyone considers her a true socialist or not. The word itself, it was a shifting term to designate a series of ideas that revolved around social reform and justice for workers.
Mm-hmm. And certainly she was political on occasion, especially in 1848.
Well, in 1848, I'm not sure we could say she was openly political. She was very much in support of the revolutionary government of 1848, and she wrote bulletins for it, but she technically was anonymous. It's just that everyone knew that she was writing them.
Oh, I see. Was that the case with Letter to the People also?
Letter to the People. Yeah. She was always trying to mediate between the rich and the poor and try to bring everyone together. Some people would claim that there was something a bit Pollyannish about what she was doing, about what she thought she could achieve.
And what about the criticism that she receives from feminists, because she was critical of proto-feminists anyway of her own time?
Yeah, this is a woman who was commercially very successful. It's because she had found ways to negotiate a very difficult double bind for women, that you're always taxed with being too aggressive or not assertive enough, too sentimental or lacking heart. And so she was someone who had managed to walk a tightrope with great success. Mm-hmm. So there's a degree to which women who were bolder or more radical or wanted more feminist reforms more urgently, that they found that hypocritical. Mm-hmm. They found it. To this day, there are literary critics who dislike her for that.
Yeah.
For me, it's not a question of judging her. It's a question of understanding what the stakes were, understanding the choices she made, comparing them to the choices other people made, and getting a picture of what it was like in the 19th century to try to be a woman writer, especially one who was politically engaged.
And she presents herself in the novel especially as someone who is kind of in the middle, doesn't she? She's from an aristocratic family and a low-born family.
It's funny you say in the novel. It's an autobiography, but it reads very much like a novel, doesn't
and
it?
And her novels read very autobiographically also, don't they?
And it's a theme that we find in her novels as much in her autobiography, mediations between the rich and the poor. Her mother was, as she said, a woman of the people, the common people. Her father was of an aristocratic descent, and she grew up caught in a bitter feud between her grandmother and her mother after her father died.
And she's also in the middle in terms of her sexuality and in terms of her identity and mediating between the masculine and the feminine and ideas of masculinity and femininity.
Yes. Interestingly, she went about, in real life, people called her George. Mm-hmm. You know, George Sand was not just her pen name. And she did enjoy wearing men's clothing. She seems to have identified strongly with her father.
In her autobiography, the point where she decides to change her name, that's the culmination of everything that's happened to her, in a sense, isn't it?
Yeah, people like to think of that as a baptism, a rebaptism for her. We have to remember, though, that she was extremely proud of being a mother. She loved domestic chores. She loved making preserves. She claims to have loved needlework, although she says after a while it gave her a headache and she had to stop. But she was definitely someone who emphasized many, many feminine and maternal characteristics at the same time she asserted masculine prerogatives.
Yeah. And there's a theoretical basis for this to some extent, isn't there, in LaRue and some of the socialists, this kind of melding of the masculine and feminine in the self?
Yeah. LaRue must have appealed to her for that. And in fact, I think there's a degree to which she herself helped shape LaRue's philosophy, after which she then claimed to be LaRue's disciple. Again, she knew how to negotiate the double bind very well.
That's very interesting. You were talking about the reaction to some of her works, and I'm thinking of her novel,
Lelia. Yes.
And you have a nice line referring at the outburst of male rage she inspired by the novel that, quote, she is the one who remains calm, whose major occupation is the fate of humanity, while the male critics about her are revealed to be over-emotional, anachronistic, driven by a rage for mutual persecution, reminiscent of the age of the Inquisition. And personally, I can't read that passage without thinking about Hillary Clinton now and the venom she inspires, even on mainstream outlets like MSNBC and Fox News.
Well, yes, we can find lots of parallels between the experiences of Senator Clinton and these women autobiographers in terms of the double bind, having to walk a tightrope, always being taxed with being too aggressive or not assertive enough. Mm-hmm. I should point out, though, that Hillary Clinton is a political candidate. All George Sand had done was write a novel gave rise to such rage. But it was a novel in which a woman doesn't find satisfaction with her male lover. She has a sensual moment with another woman. She is strangled at the end by a male priest. All these things, people understood, the critics understood that her novels were political. Mm-hmm. And they were very frustrated by that because she never came out and said, I am writing a political treatise. And she wasn't writing a political treatise. And so I think that contributed to their rage that they just didn't know how to attack this. Yeah. So they had to say it was immoral.
There's got to be some kind of lesson to be learned here from the fact that men who react this way to women who seem to be stepping out of their place and assuming political power of any kind actually betray the very weaknesses our culture has traditionally assigned to women, you know, hysteria, irrationality, petty viciousness, lack of self-control, et cetera, you know.
Yes, I think it's sad, but I think the media today, it taps into people's rage and into their baser instincts, and it does so for money as much as anything else.
Yeah, Jennifer Fegley last week talked about this phenomenon also, especially with respect to the way the critical establishment reacted to authors like Mary Elizabeth Braddon in England.
It's interesting how many things are 19th century phenomena.
Yeah.
Sometimes my colleagues in women's studies will talk about something as a Victorian phenomenon, and I'm thinking, well, but you know, that was happening in France too. There are certain things which are specifically British and specifically French, and then there are other things that draw them together. Imperialism, colonialism, the rise of the bourgeois family. Industrialization came later to France than to England. The trajectories of the different countries are different, but there are certain things that link them together.
So something interesting you said about George Sand in the book, you talk about Sand positioning herself as a writer, as a kind of scribe, writing out the universal book of providence. And I thought that was an interesting observation.
Yes.
The sort of objective, materialist, almost automatic writing self.
Well, again, that could be a strategic move.
Yeah.
You know, that there's something very self-important about writing your life story and aligning it to the history of humanity. And so to call yourself a scribe, in a sense, is a way of giving up some of your authority and pretending that providence is writing for you.
Yeah. But it is a place where the writing about the self and the writing about the world come together, that history and
Because writing about the self, in a sense, is writing about your place in the world.
Yeah.
Even if you're writing an autobiography that's about your retreat to the woods, why publish it unless you're trying to say something about your place in relation to the world?
Yeah, and the notion of providence seems to come up a lot in these autobiographies.
Yes. Yeah. People were struggling to find meaning. They were trying to give meaning to an era of chaos and change. And so they were trying to situate that in a religious framework.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that humanity changes and progresses and goes through periods of struggle and pain and anxiety in order to become better, that was a way of trying to give meaning to those times.
So after 1848, French politics took a repressive turn, and so did any hope for women from developments in socialist theory, at least to the extent it was being dominated by Pierre-Joseph Proudhon.
Yes. Well, it was a repressive regime after 1848 anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about 19th century feminism is that it was very dependent upon rights such as the right to free speech, right to assembly.
Mm-hmm.
So after each revolution, those rights were repressed in various ways, and it made it hard for anyone. I mean, the meetings were held in secret. The Blanquists had to meet in secret. So it was hard for everyone, but it was especially hard for feminists because women you know, they had less of a voice than anyone.
Yeah, but they're shut out not just by the government, but by prominent socialists also then.
That's correct. And it's not as if we can blame men for that. Yeah. There's a degree to which, well, there was the split between bourgeois and working class feminists. What happened at that point was that there was no longer a strong socialist feminist movement after the commune, especially because you ended up with bourgeois feminism that sought rights such as the right to vote. And then you had a working class movement that didn't particularly care about women's rights.
So the last person you talk about is Louise Michel, a poet, teacher, and orator, and a prominent figure of the Commune of 1871.
Yes.
Liberty leading the people, almost, you might say.
Well, there was some people called her the Red Virgin. Yeah. But once again, this is a way of reducing a single woman to a kind of a symbol.
Yeah.
Some people would say it's elevating her to a symbol.
Yeah.
But she was fighting on the barricades. She was giving speeches. She was, I suppose they would call her a rabble-rouser. Mm-hmm. She was excellent at giving speeches. And that's something, I don't have access to that. I don't have access to her voice.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest gift of all that she had is something I can only imagine. But she writes her autobiography as if she were giving a speech almost on every page.
Yeah, interesting. I wonder if her experience as a teacher had anything to do with that. But she's also a prominent poet, and poetry is very important to her. In fact, she may have identified herself mostly as a poet.
She was never considered a great poet.
No.
I don't think anyone would say she was a prominent poet.
Yeah.
She was a prominent French woman. And her autobiography, I find very innovative. Again, the style can be very off-putting to someone not acquainted with the choices, the aesthetic choices available to women at that time. But once you understand them, and especially once you understand that she was writing in prison and that the chapters had to be smuggled out of prison, it helps you understand the aesthetic and love it, I think.
You talk about the aesthetic partly in terms of commune culture, quote unquote, as an alternative to print for promoting revolutionary consciousness.
Commune culture was a way of breaking the barriers between art and life, in one sense. In another, it was a way of breaking the barriers between print and other forms of expression. Music was very important to commune culture. Anything you could do to transform the designated spaces. One of the things Louise Michel did during the commune was go into a church and start playing the organ in counterpoint to the sound of the cannons and missiles being fired. And
sounds very 1960s.
Well, exactly. And in fact, the Situationists, who were very much the hidden force behind May 1968, which people still don't acknowledge enough, were very interested in commune culture. They saw that as a precursor of what they were trying to do, the Situationist International.
Interesting. And then she does intersperse her memoirs with lots of poetry.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that this act itself of refusing to distinguish between memoir writing, speech making, poetry.
Yeah. Is there a mediation of, from a traditional perspective, a high and low culture here also? Which you do get, another thing Jennifer Fegley talked about, in the serialized women's publications that came out in England and the United States.
I think that, the thing about popular culture, what you call popular culture in 19th century France, is very much oral culture.
Yeah.
That these were people who, even when they read, they often met in working class cafes and read aloud and made jokes and used slang. And she uses slang in her autobiography. She makes sarcastic comments and with exclamation points, lots of italics. That popular culture is about people valuing expression that's not based on the privileges of having an education.
Maybe we should talk about her life a bit, just because it's an interesting life also. Her mother's very important to her, and also she's also involved with Victor Hugo.
Yes, Victor Hugo she wrote to when she was a teenager. She wanted to become a poet. She sent him her poetry, and he wrote back. And he was, in a sense, her mentor. Her mother, she was extremely close to. She was an illegitimate child. She was forced to leave the family home when her grandparents died, her paternal grandparents. And she was also forced to give up the name de Mailly when she tried to publish her poetry.
Mm-hmm.
She was not allowed to use the name of her father. And so she, I think, devoted much of her life to trying to make her mother happy, but at the same time, her mother didn't share her revolutionary ideals.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if she wanted to get back at the system that had turned her mother into this shameful, unwed mother. And yet her mother was rather conservative and always worried about her daughter and was very unhappy when her daughter was exiled to New Caledonia.
That's an interesting passage. The French government finally deals with her by treating her, as they did Napoleon in a way, as a kind of dangerous superhero they had to confine in a safe space as far away from France as they could possibly send her. Much farther, actually, than they sent Napoleon, who just went to Elba.
Yes, so. Well, a lot of the communards of 1871 were exiled to New Caledonia if they weren't executed. Louise Michel was frustrated that she wasn't executed. She thought that her dignity as a revolutionary would have been upheld if she had been executed, and instead they exiled her, which didn't stop her from engaging in revolutionary activity out in New Caledonia in the South Pacific, because she then tried to help the Melanesians overthrow the French colonists.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yes. And it's in New Caledonia that she writes most of her memoirs?
What she wrote in New Caledonia were some legends about the Kanak people, the Melanesian inhabitants there. The memoirs come
when she returns
from New Caledonia. Yeah. She engages in an anarchist demonstration and gets put in prison. And during that period, her mother died. And so she was writing her memoirs while in prison. Mm-hmm. And she writes a great deal about her grief over her mother's death. But she writes about the prostitutes she hears next door. She transcribes their conversations. Everything was material for Louise Michel for interpreting and promoting revolution. Everything she encountered.
So I usually ask this question to most of my guests on the show, just because we're interested in libraries and how people do research. Can you tell us how you went about doing your research for the book?
That was hard. You know, this started out as my doctoral dissertation. Mm-hmm. I first got interested in it while I was at the University of California, Irvine, while working with Leslie Rabin. When I went to the University of Pennsylvania, I met Frank Paul Bowman, who was the author of Le Christ des Barricades, about a post-revolutionary 19th century images of Jesus Christ as a revolutionary. And so I began to be fascinated by utopian socialism. Mm-hmm. To write my dissertation first, I had to research a great deal of French history, social movements, history of women. I had to have an overview of the autobiographical tradition. I had to study autobiography in general and French autobiography in particular, and then women's autobiography in relation to all of that. And then when it came to each individual author, I had to read all of their works, try to understand each particular period during the 19th century, 1830, 1848, 1871, so that there was a great deal of diachronic and synchronic work to be done.
So the libraries you used, did you use the French National Archives?
I sure did.
You did, yeah.
I just read autobiography after autobiography. I had a travel grant one summer, and it was just amazing to read all of these life stories. And it was what helped me understand what was innovative and very interesting about the three autobiographers that I ultimately wrote about.
Yeah.
Because I read many autobiographies that were frankly boring. It didn't go anywhere, that were a collection of memories that were interesting for me, you know, sort of anthropologically, but which couldn't really engage a reader in any way.
Yeah. You know, there's been a renaissance of women's autobiography in the 20th century of all kinds. And biography, of course, everybody knows it dominates really a publication, I would say, if you read the book reviews. We mentioned Barbara Walters' foray into the genre being a case in point. But, you know, we have so many others, including those that are clearly political. Angela Davis and Emma Goldman come to mind. And there are hundreds and hundreds more. And I wonder, do you see any differences or similarities in the autobiographies we've been talking about and these 20th century autobiographies?
Well, if you look at the examples you give, I think Angela Davis and Emma Goldman, these are the autobiographies that I think will last. These are the ones, and I'm trying to understand why is it that they're so engaging, that they're so powerful. It's precisely because they're making a connection between the personal and the social in a way that causes you to think.
And there are clearly narratives there also in both cases, aren't there? It's not just a chronicle of this happened and then that happened.
Yes. Yeah. I think one of the tragedies today, if there are so many memoirs and autobiographies, the people are perhaps giving much too much importance to their own personal dramas.
Well, you know, we have today the phenomenon of the blog, which is a kind of personal form, a diary form,
yes.
really turned into a kind of public vehicle, which is, you know, interesting
yes.
in its own right, but
yes.
Not really autobiography, but more in the vein of
yes.
chronicle, if anything, if assuming you keep them up. But, you know, I'm thinking of Arianna Huffington's blog, which is a political
yes.
blog, but you couldn't really read that as autobiography quite, because it's become a kind of news outlet.
Yeah, so. That autobiography is retrospective.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the more people write, the less, I think, in the end, people will read seriously. If anyone can just throw out something and make it public overnight, it has me wondering if the rise of the graphic novel is a response to that. That the graphic novel that requires illustrations as well as captions. And I'm thinking of Alison Bechdel's Fun Home,
mm-hmm.
which is autobiography, and which was named one of the most important books of the year by New York Review of Books.
Mm-hmm.
That year it was published. That it takes a certain effort to draw and write. And today everybody is writing, and it's degrading the worth of language
mm-hmm.
when just anybody can just throw anything out.
Funny, Steiner mentions in that essay, Bluebeard's Castle, one of the things that gets him thinking is he sees Shakespeare in comic book form, coming out in comic book form, and he's mm-hmm. trying to come to terms as a traditional critic with his popular culture,
mm-hmm.
with the music blaring out of the dormitory windows on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see some part of him is disturbed by this, but the more he thinks about it, the more interesting mm-hmm. it becomes for him. And then he finally comes around to seeing a value in this commune culture, and certainly in the music, and he emphasizes the importance of remaining hopeful, that without hope, history is useless, and he cites Dante here, that there is no history in hell.
Mm-hmm.
And implied in all of this is the necessity of history in some vein, although we need to reformulate past models of culture, since we really have moved beyond them. And you can't reformulate the past if you don't have an idea of what you're reformulating, so history, it seems to me, is important here.
I think what worries me is the question of what is the past?
Yeah,
what
yeah.
will be the past?
Yeah.
I mean, to me, one of the most significant events so far of this century, if not the most significant, is Hurricane Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, people will say, well, what about 9/11? I think 9/11 is more significant in that it got us into invading a country in the most ill-conceived way. And Hurricane Katrina, to me, is the pivotal event that should have mobilized people, that should have dominated our national discourse. And so what worries me is that there just doesn't seem to be a consensus anymore about what is significant.
Yeah, one of the problems with the invasion of Iraq is that history wasn't taken into consideration, not to mention information readily available about the present. You know, if the Bush administration were a brain, in fact, you'd have to say it's a brain with severe cognitive dysfunction with respect to access to memory and the ability to use memory to distinguish fact from phantasm and coming to terms with the real.
I think that reality now is being acknowledged, that will become part of the history of Iraq. But my question is, will Katrina become equally important? Because I think it is.
Yeah.
Its relationship to so many things, our neglect of poor people, the failure of our government to help so many people who were begging for help, the potential relationship to global warming, the strength of the hurricanes.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I'm expressing my frustration that my idea of what history should be. But again, it's worrisome that our sense of history seems to depend so much on the corporate media.
Well, there needn't be one version of history, of course, but not all versions are equal, especially those, I guess, that ignore human suffering. And again, I have to think of Jules Michelet, who conceived of his great project to write the history of the revolution as a matter of speaking for the dead, whose dust he imagined himself breathing in the French National Archives in Paris. But in any case, although it might not be of much use to those directly affected by Katrina in the present, what happens around us, and this certainly is the case with Katrina and its aftermath, is well documented. And I believe this is precisely what libraries and, to some extent, the academy are for, you know, to redress cognitive dysfunction, so to speak, by providing for the possibility to reformulate experience for the benefit of the future. And that would be a social benefit for those of us who are still of an idealistic bent. So I'd like to thank you, Kathleen, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today and talking about your book. We've been talking with Kathleen Hart, Associate Professor of French and Francophone Studies here at Vassar today, about her book, Revolution and Women's Autobiography in 19th Century France. Tune in next week, which will be our season finale this academic year, when we'll be talking with William Noel, curator of manuscripts and rare books at the Walters Art Gallery in Baltimore, about his book entitled The Archimedes Codex, How a Medieval Prayer Book is Revealing the True Genius of Antiquity's Greatest Scientist. And we'll be back on the Library Cafe right after this public service announcement.
Did you know that 2/3 of Americans have library cards? So what's stopping you? Drop by your local library today and get a library card. It'll be the smartest card in your wallet. A message from the American Library Association's Campaign for America's Libraries.